Chapter 3. One would have to go back to the year 1994, the year that West Germany entered the Union as the 53rd of the United States, to understand why Vince Streichrock, an American citizen and an inhabitant of the Abraham Lincoln Apartments, was listening to Der Alte on the television set while he shaved the next morning. There was something about this particular Der Alte, President Rudi Kalbfleisch, which always irritated him, and it would be a great thing when Kalbfleisch, in two more years, reached the end of his term and had, by law, to retire. It was always a great thing, a good day when the law got one of them out of office. Vince always found it worth celebrating. Nonetheless, Vince felt it was best to do all that was possible with the old man while he remained in office. And so he put down his razor and went into the living room to fiddle with the knobs of the TV set. He adjusted the N, the R, and B knobs, and hopefully anticipated a turn for the better in the dire droning on of the speech. However, no change took place. Too many other viewers had their own ideas as to what the old man ought to be saying, Vince realized. In fact, there were probably enough other people in this one apartment building alone to offset any pressures he might try to exert on the old man through his particular set. But anyhow, that was democracy. Vince sighed. This was what they had wanted, a government receptive to what the people said. He returned to the bathroom and continued shaving.
"Hey, Julie," he called to his wife, "is breakfast about ready?"
He heard no sound of her stirring about in the kitchen of the apartment, and come to think of it, he hadn't noticed her beside him in bed as he had groggily gotten up this morning. All at once he remembered. Last night, after All Souls, he and Julie, after a particularly bitter fight, had gotten divorced, had gone down to the building's M&D commissioner and filled out the D papers. Julie had packed her things then and there. He was alone in the apartment. No one was fixing his breakfast, and unless he got busy, he would miss it entirely. It was a shock, because this particular marriage had endured for 6 entire months, and he had become thoroughly used to seeing her in the mornings. She knew just how he liked his eggs, cooked with a small amount of mild Munster cheese. Damn the new permissive divorce legislation that old President Kalbfleisch had ushered in. Damn Kalbfleisch in general. Why didn't the old man turn over and die some afternoon during his famous 2 o'clock nap? But then, of course, another Der Alte would simply take his place, and even the old man's death wouldn't bring Julie back. That lay outside the area of USEA bureaucracy, vast as it was. Savagely, he went to the TV set and pressed the S knob. If enough citizens pushed it, the old man would stop entirely. The stop knob meant total cessation of the mumbling speech. Vince waited, but the speech went on. And then it struck him as odd that there should be a speech so early in the morning. After all, it was only 8 a.m. Perhaps the entire lunar colony had gone up in a single titanic explosion of its fuel depot. The old man would be telling them that more belt tightening was required in order to restock the space program. These and other quaint calamities had to be expected. Or perhaps, at last, some authentic remains of a sentient race had been unearthed. Or was the term unmarsed on the fourth planet? Hopefully not in the French area, but in, as Der Alte liked to phrase it, one's own.
You Prussian bastards, Vince thought. We never should have admitted you into what I like to phrase as our tent, our federal union, which should have been confined to the Western Hemisphere. But the world has shrunk. When you are founding a colony millions of miles away on another moon or planet, the 3,000 miles separating New York from Berlin did not seem meaningful. And God knew the Germans in Berlin were willing. Picking up the phone, Vince called the manager of the apartment building.
My wife, Julie, I mean, my ex-wife, did she take another apartment last night?
If he could locate her, he could perhaps have breakfast with her, and that would be cheering.
He listened hopefully.
No, Mr. Strikerack.
A pause.
Not according to our records.
Oh, hell, Vince thought and hung up. What was marriage, anyhow? An arrangement of sharing things, such as, right now, being able to discuss the meaning of Der Alter, giving an 8 a.m. speech and getting someone else, his wife,
to fix breakfast while he prepared to go to his job at Karp Usonenwerke's Detroit branch.
Yes, it meant an arrangement in which one could get another person to do certain things one didn't like to do, such as cooking meals. He hated having to eat food which he had prepared himself. Single, he would eat at the building's cafeteria. He foresaw that based on past experience. Mary, Jean, Laura, now Julie. 4 marriages, and the last, the shortest. He was going downhill. Maybe, God forbid, he was a latent queer. On the TV, Der Alter uttered, "And paramilitary activity recalls the days of barbarism, and hence is doubly to be renounced."
Days of barbarism.
That was the sweet talk for the Nazi period of the middle part of the previous century. Now gone nearly a century, but still vividly, if distortedly, recalled. So Der Alter had taken to the airwaves to denounce the Sons of Job, the latest nut organization of a quasi-religious nature, flapping about in the streets, proclaiming a purification of national ethnic life, etc., or whatever it was they proclaimed. In other words, stiff legislation to bar persons from public life who were odd. Those born, especially, due to the years of radiation fallout from bomb testing, in particular from the vicious People's China blasts. That would mean Julie, Vince conjectured, since she's sterile. Because she could not bear children, she would not be permitted to vote. A rather neurotic connective, logically possible only in the minds of a Central European people such as the Germans.
"The tail that wags the dog," he said to himself as he dried his face. "We in North America are the dog, the Reich is the tail." What a life.
Maybe I ought to emigrate to colonial reality, live under a faint, fitful, pale yellow sun where even things with 8 legs and a stinger get to vote. No Sons of Job there. Not that all these special people were that special, but a good many of them had seen fit, and for good reason, to emigrate, as had quite a number of quite unspecial folk who were simply tired of the overpopulated, bureaucratically controlled life on Terra these days, whether in the USEA, in the French Empire, or in People's Asia, or free, that is, black, Africa. In the kitchen, he fixed himself bacon and eggs, and while the bacon cooked, he fed the sole pet allowed him in the apartment building, George III, his small green turtle. George III ate dried flies, 25% protein, more nourishing than human food, hamburger, and ant eggs, a breakfast which caused Vince Strikerock to ponder on the axiom, "De gustibus non disputandum est." There's no accounting for other people's tastes, especially at 8 in the morning. Even as recently as 5 years ago, he could have possessed a pet bird in the Abraham Lincoln, but that was now ruled out. Too noisy, really. Building rule S205, "Thou shalt not whistle, sing, tweet, or chirp." A turtle was mute, as was a giraffe, but giraffes were verboten too, along with the quondam friends of man, the dog and cat, the companions which had vanished back in the days of Der Alter, Friedrich Hempel, whom Vince barely remembered. So it could not have been the quality of muteness, and he was left, as so often before, merely to guess at the reasoning of the party bureaucracy. He could not genuinely fathom its motives, and in a sense,
For that, he was glad. It proved that he was not spiritually a part of it. On the TV, the withered, elongated, near-senile face had vanished, and a moment of music, a purely audible event, had replaced it. Percy Grainger, a tune called Handle on the Strand, as banal as could be, just the appropriate postscript to what had come before, Vince reflected. He clicked his heels abruptly, came to attention in a parody of Germanic military stiffness, chin up, arms rigid, as the melody tinkled from the speaker of the TV set. Vince Strikerock had attention to this child's music which the authorities, the so-called guests, saw fit to play.
Heil, Vince said to himself, and raised his arm in the ancient Nazi salute.
The music tinkled on. Vince turned to another channel. And there, on the screen, a hounded-looking man fleetingly appeared in the midst of a crowd which seemed to be cheering him. The man, with what were obviously police on both sides of him, disappeared into a parked vehicle. At the same time, the newscaster declared, "And just as in hundreds of other cities across the USEA, Dr. Jack Dowling, leading psychiatrist of the Vienna School here in Bonn, is taken into custody as he protests the newly signed into law bill, the McPherson Act." On the screen, the vehicle, a marked police car, zipped away.
A hell of a note, Vince thought glumly. Sign of the times. More repressive, scared legislation by the establishment. So, who am I going to get help from if Julie's departure causes me to break down mentally? As well it might. I've never consulted an analyst. I've never needed to in my entire life, but this, nothing like this, precisely this bad, has ever happened to me. Julie, he thought, where are you?
Now, on the TV screen, the scene changed, and yet it remained the same. Vince Strikerock saw a new crowd, different police, another psychoanalyst being led off, another protesting soul taken into custody. It is interesting, the TV set murmured, to observe the loyalty of the analyst's patient. And yet, why not? This man has placed his faith in psychoanalysis, possibly for years.
And where did it get him? Vince wondered.
Julie, he said to himself,
if you're with someone, some other man right now, there's going to be trouble. Either I'll drop dead, either it will kill me outright, or I'm going to give it to you and that individual, whoever he is, even if, especially if he's a friend of mine. I'm going to get you back, he decided. My relationship with you is unique, not like that with Mary, Jean, and Laura. I love you. That's it. My God, he thought, I'm in love. And in this day and age, incredible. If I told her, if she knew, she'd laugh her head off. That's Julie. I should go to an analyst, he realized. For being in a state like this, for being totally psychologically dependent on a cold, selfish creature like Julie for existence itself, hell, it's unnatural, and it's folly. Could Dr. Jack Dowling, leading psychiatrist of the Vienna School in Bonn, Germany, cure me? Free me? Or this other man they're showing this? He listened to the newscaster, who droned on as the police vehicle drove away. Egon Superb. He had looked like an intelligent, sympathetic person, gifted with the balm of empathic understanding. Listen, Egon Superb, Vince thought. I'm in deep trouble. My tiny world collapsed this morning when I woke up. I need a woman whom I'll probably never see again. A.G. Chemie's drugs can't help me with this, except perhaps a mortal overdose, and that's not the sort of help I'm after. Maybe I should roust out my brother Chick, and both of us join the sons of Job, he thought abruptly. Chick and I swear fealty to Berthold Goltz. Others have done so, other malcontents, others who have dismally failed, either in their private lives, as I have, or in business, or in their social ascent from B to G. Chick and I, sons of Job, Vince Strikerock thought eerily. In bizarre uniform, parading down the street, being jeered at, and yet believing in what? In ultimate victory? In Goltz, who looks like a movie version of a Rattenfanger, a rat catcher? He cringed from the notion. It frightened him. And still the idea remained lodged in his mind. In his apartment on the top floor of the Abraham Lincoln Apartments, thin, balding Chick Strikerock, Vince's older brother, awoke and peered nearsightedly at the clock to see if one could manage to remain in bed a bit longer. But the excuse was not valid. The clock read 8:15. Time to get up. A news machine, noisily vending its wares outside the building, had awakened him, fortunately. And then Chick discovered to his shock that someone was in bed with him. He opened his eyes fully and made himself rigid as he inspected the covered outline of what he saw at once from the tumble of brown hair was a young woman and one familiar. That was a relief, or was it, to him? Julie, his sister-in-law, his brother Vince's wife. Good grief! Chick sat up. Let's see, he said to himself rapidly. Last night, what did go on here after All Souls, anyhow? Julie appeared, didn't she? Distraught, with one suitcase and two coats, and telling a disjointed story which boiled down to a simple fact at last. She had broken up with Vince legally. She no longer had any official relationship to him and was free to come and go as she pleased. So here she was. Why? That part he couldn't remember. He had always liked Julie, but it did not explain this. What she had done concerned her own secret inner world of values and attitudes, not his, not anything that was objective, real. Anyhow, here Julie was, still sound asleep, too, here physically, but withdrawn into herself, curled up, retracted mollusk-like, which was just as well, because for him it all seemed incestuous, despite the clarity of the law in this variety of matter. She, to him, was more like family. He had never looked in her direction. But last night, after a few drinks, that was it. He could not drink any more. Or rather, he could. And when he did, he underwent a rapid change for what at the time seemed like the better. He became outgoing, adventurous, extroverted, instead of morose and taciturn. But here was a consequence. Look what he had gotten involved in here. And yet on a very deep, private level, he didn't object as much as all that. It was a compliment to him, her showing up here. But it would be awkward, the next time he ran into Vince, checking everyone's ID at the front door, because Vince would want to discuss it on a profound, meaningful, somber basis, with much intellectual hot air wasted in analyzing basic motives. What was Julie's real purpose for leaving him and moving in here? Why? Ontological questions, such as Aristotle would have appreciated. Teleological issues having to do with what they had once called final causes. Vince was out of step with the times. This had all become null and void. I better call my boss, Chick decided, and tell him. Ask him if I can be late today. Should settle this with Julie. What's up and so forth. How long is she staying, and is she going to help pay expenses? Basic, unphilosophical questions of practical nature. He fixed coffee in the kitchen, sat sipping in his pajamas. Turning on the phone, he punched his boss's number, Maury Frauenzimmer. The screen turned pale gray, then white, then cloudy, as an out-of-focus portion of Maury's anatomy formed.
Maury was shaving.
Yeah, Chick.
Hey, Chick said, and heard it sound forth proudly. I got a girl here, Maury, so I'll be late.
It was male-to-male business. Did not matter who the girl was, no need to go into that.
Maury did not bother to ask. He showed on his face the involuntary, genuine admiration, then censure.
But the admiration came first.
Chick grinned. The censure did not bother him.
God damn you, Maury said. You better get into the office by no later than 9.
His tone said, I wish I were you. I envy you, damn you.
Ah, Chick said, I'll be in soon as I can.
He glanced toward the bedroom and Julie. She was sitting up. Perhaps Maury saw her, perhaps not. In any case, it was time to conclude the conversation.
So long, Maury, old man,
Chick said and rang off.
Who's that?
Julie said sleepily.
Was that Vince?
No, my boss.
Chick put on the coffee water for her. Hi, he said, walking back into the bedroom and seating himself on the bed beside her.
How are you?
I forgot my comb,
Julie said pragmatically.
I'll buy you one from the hall dispenser.
Those measly little plastic things?
He said, feeling fond of her, feeling sentimental. The situation, she in bed, he sitting beside her in his pajamas, it was a bittersweet situation, reminding him of his own previous last marriage of 4 months ago.
Hi,
he said, patting her on the thigh.
Oh, God,
Julie said.
I wish I was dead.
She did not say it accusingly, as if it was his fault, or even as if she meant it passionately. It was as if she were resuming a conversation from the night before.
What is the purpose of it all, Chick? I like Vince, but he's so goofy. He'll never grow up and really bear down at the business of living. He's always playing his games of being the embodiment of modern organized social life, the stab man, pure and simple, whereas actually he's not. But he's young,
she sighed. It was a sigh that chilled Chick because it was a cold, cruel, utterly dismissing sigh. She was writing off another human being, severing herself from Vince with as little spilled emotion as if she had returned a book borrowed from the building's library.
Good grief, Chick thought. This man was your husband. You were in love with him. You slept with him, lived with him, knew all there was to know about him. In fact, knew him better than I can, and he's been my brother for longer than you've been alive. Women down underneath, he thought, are tough. Terribly tough.
I have to get to work,
Chick said nervously.
Is that coffee you have on for me in there?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Bring it here, then, will you, Chick?
He went to get the coffee while she dressed.
Did old Kalbfleisch make his speech this morning?
Julie asked.
I don't know.
It hadn't occurred to him to turn on the TV, although he had read in the paper last night that the speech was due. He didn't give a damn what the old man had to say about anything.
Do you really have to trot off to your little company and go to work?
She eyed him steadily, and he saw, for what perhaps was the first time in his life, that she had lovely, natural color in her eyes, a polished slab texture of rock smoothness and brilliance that needed the natural daylight for it to be brought out. She had, too, an odd, square jaw and a slightly large mouth with a tendency to turn down, tragedy mask-like, with her lips unnaturally red and lush, drawing attention away from her rather drably colored hair. She had a nice figure, rounded, pleasant, and she dressed well. That is, she looked splendid in whatever she wore. Clothes seemed to fit her, even mass-produced cotton dresses that other women would have had difficulty with. Now she stood wearing the same olive-colored dress with round black buttons which she had worn the night before. A cheap dress, really, and yet in it she looked elegant. There was no other word for it. She had an aristocratic carriage and bone structure,
It showed in her jaw, her nose, her excellent teeth. She was not German, but she was Nordic, perhaps Swedish or Danish. He thought, as he glanced at her, that she looked fine. It seemed to him certain that she would hold together well over the years, not deteriorate. She seemed to be unbreakable. He could not imagine her getting sloppy or fat or dull.
"I'm hungry," Julie said.
"You mean you want me to fix breakfast?" He perceived that, no doubt there.
"I fixed all the breakfast I'm going to fix for any man, you or your dumb kid brother," Julie said.
Again he experienced fear. She was being too harsh, too soon. He knew her, knew she was this way, but couldn't it be glossed over, at least for a while? Was she going to bring to him whatever her last mood with Vince had been? Wasn't there going to be a honeymoon?
"I think I'm in trouble," he thought to himself. "I've gotten hold of just too much here. I'm not up to it. God, maybe she'll move on. I hope so."
It was a childish hope, very regressive, not grown up, masculine. No real man ever felt this way. He realized that.
"I'll fix breakfast," he said, and went into the kitchen to do so.
Julie stood at the bedroom mirror, combing her hair.
Curtly, in his usual brisk tone, Garth McRae said, "Shut it off." The Kalbfleisch simulacrum stopped. Its arms stuck out, rigid in their final gesture, the withered face vacuous. The simulacrum said nothing, and automatically the TV cameras also shut off, one by one. There was no longer anything for them to transmit, and the technicians behind them, all of them, guests, knew it. They looked to Garth McRae.
"We got the message across," McRae informed Anton Karp.
"Well done," Karp said. "This Bertolt Goltz, this Sons of Job man, makes me nervous. I think the speech here now this morning will dispel a little of that, my legitimate fear."
He glanced timidly at McRae for confirmation, as were the others in the control room, the simulacrum engineers from the Karpwerke.
"This is only the start," McRae said presently.
"True," Karp agreed, nodding. "But a good start."
Walking up to the Kalbfleisch simulacrum, he touched it gingerly on the shoulder, as if expecting it, prodded, to resume its activity. It did not. McRae laughed.
I wish, Anton Karp said, "that it had mentioned Adolf Hitler, you know, comparing the Sons of Job to the Nazis more directly, comparing Goltz to Hitler."
"But," McRae said, "that would not have helped, true as it may be. You're not authentically a political person, Karp. What gives you the idea that the truth is the best story to stick to? If we want to stop Bertolt Goltz, we don't want to identify him as another Hitler, simply because in their secret hearts, 51% of the local population would like to see another Hitler." He smiled at Karp, who looked worried, who looked, in fact, tremulous and apprehensive.
"What I want to know," Karp said, "is this. Is Kalbfleisch going to be able to handle the Sons of Job? You have von Lessinger equipment, tell me."
"No," McRae said. "He won't be able to." Karp gaped at him.
"But," McRae said, "Kalbfleisch is going to go. Soon, within the next month."
He did not say what Karp at once wanted him to say, what Anton and Felix Karp and the entire Karpwerke instinctively inquired into as a first reflex, an immediate query of primary magnitude. Will we build the next simulacrum? Karp would have asked had he dared, but he was afraid to speak. Karp was, as McRae knew, a coward. His integrity had long ago been emasculated in order that he be capable of functioning properly within the German business community. Spiritual, moral emasculation was a present-day prerequisite for participation in the Gee class, in the ruling circles.
I could tell him, McCrae thought, ease his pain. But why?
He did not like Karp, who had built and now maintained the simulacrum, kept it functioning as it had to function, without even a trace of hesitation. Any failure would have betrayed to the beasts the secret, the kindness which distinguished the elite, the establishment of the United States of Europe and America. Their possession of the one or more secrets made them into Geheimnistrage, bearers of the secret, rather than Befeldtrage, mere carrier-outers of instructions. But all this, to McCrae, was Germanic mysticism. He preferred to think of it in simple, practical terms. Karp Usonenwerke was capable of building simulacra, had, as an example, built Kalbfleisch and done a good job of it, as well as a good job of maintaining this Der Alte during his reign. However, another firm would construct the next Der Alte equally well, and by eradicating the economic ties with Karp, the government cut the vast cartel out of participation in the economic privileges which it now enjoyed, to the government's loss. The next firm which built a simulacrum for the government of the USEA would be a small firm, one which the authorities could control. The name which came to McRae's mind was Frauenzimmer Associates, an extremely small, marginal firm barely surviving in the field of SimCon, simulacra construction for planetary colonization. He did not tell Anton Karp this, but he intended to open business discussions with Maurice Frauenzimmer, the head of the firm, any day now. And it would surprise Frauenzimmer, too. He did not know either. Karp said thoughtfully, eyeing McRae,
"What do you think Nicole will say?"
Smiling, McRae said, "I think she'll be glad. She never really liked old Rudy."
"I thought she did."
Karp looked chagrined. "The First Lady," McRae said acidly, "has never liked a Der Alte yet. Why should she? After all, she's 23, and Kalbfleisch was, according to our informational poop sheets, 78. Karp bleated.
"But what does she have to do with him? Nothing. Just appear at a reception very seldom, just every now and then."
"I think that Nicole in general detests the old, the outworn, the useless," McRae said, not sparing Anton Karp. He saw the middle-aged businessman wince. "Which is a good shorthand description of your chief product."
"But the specifications, you could have made it a trifle more,"
McRae searched for the word,
"fascinating."
"Enough," Karp said, flushing, knowing now that McRae was merely tormenting him, that this all was simply to drive home the point that as large and powerful as it was, Karp Usonenwerke was a servant, only an employee of the government. It did not really influence it, and even McRae, who was simply an assistant secretary of state, could take a stand of this sort with impunity.
"If you ran things once more," McRae drawled reflectively, "how would you alter matters?
Go back to hiring concentration camp victims as Krupp did during the 20th century?
Perhaps you could obtain and use von Lessinger equipment for that, letting them die even faster as your employees than they died at Bergen-Belsen."
Karp turned and strode off. He was trembling. Grinning, McRae lit a cigar. An American, not a German-Dutch variety.